Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is today's Cuba different from the communist dictatorship once ruled by Fidel Castro, and what remains unchanged? Now headed by Raul Castro, the country has recently begun experimenting with cutting the size of its government labor force and allowing some private enterprise and land ownership. But although Cubans enjoy free health care and schooling, the Byzantine economic system, which includes two separate currencies, leaves many well-educated professionals struggling to make ends meet in their chosen fields. And as my guest today will tell us, even Cubans who remain fiercely loyal to their country can understand why many of their friends and relatives wish to leave. Journalist Cynthia Gorney is a contributor to National Geographic magazine. She spent 9 weeks in Cuba over the past 2 years to report her story, Cuba's New Now, which appears in the November issue of the magazine. Cynthia, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Lovely to be with you.
So if the Cubans you met for this story had a shared mantra, it was, I love my country and it doesn't work.
That is right. I found many things that surprised me in Cuba. One of them was people's willingness to talk very openly if they were not in a public setting where they feared that they might be seen by neighbors or someone who might report them to the wrong arm of the government about their very complicated feelings about the country. I am a Spanish speaker, and so when I had thought it would be a lot harder to get people to get going, and I found that it was about as difficult as getting into a car or some other private place and basically turning to the person next to me and saying, so. And then an hour later, Cubans are very well educated, very talkative in general. I hate to generalize about nationalities, but I think it is fair to say of Cubans generally that there is a great sense of humor, warmth, and talkativity among the Cuban people, very opinionated. And one of the undisputed successes of the Cuban Revolution has been the widespread education, mm-hmm. so that anywhere you went in Cuba, you were very likely to be talking, if the person was over 15 years old, you were talking to someone who had a good education, a lot of opinions, and understood him or herself to be in the middle of a great, big, very problematic social experiment in which many big questions are being asked all the time.
One of many things in your story that took me by surprise, Cynthia, was the fact that some of those who wish to leave are wanting to leave because they are frustrated and not necessarily because they are actively persecuted by the government.
That is very much true. One of the things that is viewed, I think, in an unbalanced way here from the lens of the United States is the role that so-called dissidents play in Cuba. I'm quick to say there certainly are such dissidents. There is a small community of people in Cuba who are known to be public critics of many aspects of the government, the most famous of whom is a woman named Yoni Sanchez, who has a blog that she writes for. She also tweets a great deal. And because these people have many supporters outside the country, and because the information that emanates from Cuba is limited for a variety of reasons, many of those having to do with the Cuban communication industry, if you will, itself, the word from the dissidents gets a great deal of traction outside the country. And I don't mean to say that these dissidents are not speaking the truth as they see it or anything along those lines. It's just that, for example, when you go into Cuba, Yoni Sanchez has hundreds of thousands of followers outside, people who are interested in Cuba, who get her tweets and have given her international awards and so on. Inside Cuba, she just does not command very much of an audience or attention. And this is among a people who are intensely critical of their own country and its own failings. But they will say of people like that, I've heard the term whiner-in-chief used inside Cuba. And although there's no question among the Cubans that these dissidents are persecuted in various ways, occasionally they are put into jail, they are hassled, they are arrested, their houses are watched, people who go to visit them are reported on. At the same time, the general feeling among Cuba is they're not our problem. Our problems are much more complicated and much more economically centered than that. So people who perceive it just as a place of political repression are misreading the nature of modern Cuba.
How unfettered is Cubans' access to information from and about the outside world?
It's a really good and complicated question. The Cuban press is terrible. The main national newspaper, Granma, is officially the organ of the Communist Party, and it's a national joke among people who are actually looking for news. My favorite story, lead story of the whole paper when I was in Cuba at one point was, and this is the main story down the right side, that is the main thing, was new Fidel memoir well-received at Venezuelan book fair. That was the main story. And this was while houses were falling down and people were dying and the economy is in turmoil and so on. On the other hand, it's very complicated and interesting because there is a very robust literature and public discussion in Cuba with a great deal of very sharp political comedy that appears in novels, in fiction, in stage comedy routines, sometimes even on television shows, although they're not the news shows. The news shows also are terrible and cause a lot of eye rolling. But I watched some very biting political commentary just on comedy sitcoms, for example. Mm-hmm. More sharp than you would see in a typical American sitcom. So, and I wandered in one town that I was visiting, just by accident, I wandered into an art gallery that had a display of, I believe, it didn't call itself political humor. It was something like just humor in drawing. And the first room that I walked into had some of the sharpest political cartooning that I've seen in any country. I mean, just blatantly angry at the Cuban government, somebody giving a press conference with a great big piece of duct tape over his mouth. And this is in a very public display. So it's a little oversimplified to say, quote, the press is censored. That's number one. Number two is that the Cuban internet censorship is much more either nuanced or disorganized, depending on your perspective, than one reads about, for example, in China. The way it works in Cuba, you can, for example, if I, as a foreigner, can walk into any good-sized hotel in Cuba, pay money, sit down at the internet, and have what most of the time I saw to be unfettered internet access. I can read the blogging, the dissident blogger I was referring to, Yulani Sanchez, I can read her blog, which is a collection of a bunch of variously kinds of critical voices, sitting in a hotel in Cuba, and there's nothing pops up on the screen saying you can't read this. I think there are some things that they will censor, but far fewer than you read about elsewhere. However, the access itself to the internet is limited in some complex but very effective ways. In the outside Havana, in the countryside, and the other cities as well, in the central and eastern part of Cuba, although this is not supposed to be official policy, I walked many times into the centers where most people are supposed to get their phone stuff and their internet stuff taken care of, because internet is very expensive to have in your home, although people do have it.
Well, that's one way to limit access.
That's one
right?
way to limit access. It's very expensive. But second, in these supposedly public access places, where if you have a cell phone, for example, in your cube, and you take care of your cell phone matters by walking into a central office, and there are going to be 8 terminals in that central office. And I walked into offices where it said right there on the front desk, non-Cubans, if you do not have a foreign passport, you cannot use these terminals. And I remember having a heated exchange with a young woman I was working in one of those offices, in which I said, so if I walk in here with my Cuban friend, I can use the internet, but my Cuban friend cannot if they don't have an American passport. And she said, and she gave me what I came to know and sort of love in a complicated way, the Cuban facial expression of, I know this is really terrible, and it's not my rule. It's the rule that someone handed to me. No está autorizado. It's not authorized. Mm-hmm. You just can't do it. I'm sorry. I know this doesn't make any sense. In Havana, there were some places where that distinction was not made. Anybody could walk in and use it if they put down ID, but it is so expensive that it is automatically restricted to very few numbers of Cubans. The other ways that Cubans get internet access is they steal it in their homes. Stealing things from the workplace or any place else for your personal use is widely practiced in Cuba and is widely considered to be a perfectly okay means of survival. And there is a technological training program that takes place at the graduate levels, which is pretty odd since they don't have national internet access. Now, in Cuba, the standard line on the part of the Cuban officials is that the reason the internet access is so limited is it's all because of the embargo. Cuba makes a practice of blaming everything that goes wrong with its own infrastructure on the very real American ban against doing commerce, tourist trade, et cetera, with Cuba. Mm-hmm. But Cubans think it's a joke that the Cuban government will blame anything that goes wrong within Cuba on the embargo. And I never met a single Cuban who believed the Cubans' line that the reason the internet was limited in Cuba was that Americans' inability to sell technology to Cuba had kept them from putting the kind of infrastructure that would be required for internet access into the country. Nobody believes that. Everybody believes that what happens from the government's perspective is that if you expose the entire nation to the full range of the internet, what you get in Cuba is, and think about this from the Cubans' perspective, you get not only the kind of international news and so on that democratic Americans would like to believe ought to be available to everybody. You also get a fantastic wave of A, pornography, which we know is a huge industry on the internet, right? Mm-hmm. B, commerce, which we know is the along with pornography, the second huge industry on the internet. So you get this huge influx of everything that is negative in the Cubans' eyes about international capitalism. Amazon gets to display perhaps all of its vast range of products to a country that has tried not to allow that kind of materialism in. And finally, you get the full barrage of anti-Cuban propaganda written by a community, albeit small, a powerful community centralized in the United States that genuinely wishes the government undone. This is mm-hmm. not hyperbole. The strongest anti-Castro Cubans who are centered in Miami really still do want the government overthrown. So it's not paranoia on the part of certain thinkers to say, if we open up the internet, these people are going to get their propaganda in and we want to keep it out. This is not a defense, mind you, of limiting the internet in the way that the Cuban officials have done. And this limiting remains a source of tremendous frustration and irritation to Cubans that I talk to. And interestingly, I would run these arguments past Cubans. I would say, look, I'm going to channel the voice of a government official and say, if you open the internet up to everybody, you're going to get this huge wave of commerce and pornography and anti-Cuba propaganda. And they would say, over and over, I heard people say, yes, all that is true, and we're grown-ups. We get to make that decision ourselves. Hmm. You protect people from what they can see and read until they're 18, and after they're 18, you let them make their own decision. We are an educated people. We can do this, and this is outrageous that they won't let us make this decision.
Are those anti-Cuban government activists that are in the U.S. and other places still a source of remittance income for Cuba?
Yes, it's very complex. Bear in mind that the Cuban Revolution took place in 1959. So between those years, for the next decade and a half, you really had the first wave of people who were deeply disaffected by what happened, who either were outraged by the notion of a socialist communist revolution from the very beginning, or were supporters in the beginning and then became very angry about what they saw as the totalitarian creep mm-hmm. of what was happening. Those people are now getting to be elderly. They're in their 70s and up. And those people and their direct relatives and those who also are business invested in Cuba are the ones who are still the source of rage. But we can talk in a little bit, I guess, about the fact that there's a younger generation with a very different attitude.
Quite right. We will take a quick break right now from our discussion with journalist Cynthia Gorney. She is author of the article Cuba's New Now in the November issue of National Geographic magazine. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Cynthia Gorney is my guest. Her story, Cuba's New Now, appears in the November issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. And Cynthia, before the break, you set us up beautifully for discussing in this part of the show the difference in terms of various generations in the understanding of the Cuban government and what it means to their lives and their prospects for the future.
Sure. We were talking before the break about the fact that the first wave who left are the people who are now in their 70s and up, who in large part carry the deepest rage toward the changes that occurred in Cuba. And I did spend some time in Miami just to absorb that community a little bit in the course of this reporting, and there's still, for example, a station called Radio Mambí in Miami that is nothing but propaganda against Cuba, that constantly refers to Cuba as the worst place on earth and as a totalitarian dictatorship and so on. And that airs all day long in people's cars and homes for a certain community in Miami. What's changing, though, is two things. Number one, the waves of people who have left Cuba in the last really 20 to 30 years contain many more who left not because what distressed them most was the lack of political freedom, but because they could not make it economically and because they were really frustrated by a system that, by its very nature, discourages individual enterprise and individual profit-making. And they bailed, and they don't carry the sort of really passionate emotional rage against Cuba that the first generation of exiles do. They are the ones who, so a couple things are happening. First of all, the exiles, the original exiles are having children and grandchildren now. And there was a moving piece, for example, in the New York Times that ran a few weeks ago by a woman who had to basically lie to her own father when she finally decided to go back and visit the family. She told her relatives and friends to tell her that to tell him that she was doing something else when she went to Miami because she was afraid that he would just have a heart attack. He'd be so outraged. And when she came back, he got over it. He basically said, "How did it look? How are people?" and so on. So even that is changing. The kids and the grandkids are going and seeing Cuba not because they want to move back there or reclaim it, but because they want to reclaim family ties. And as they travel, and this gets back to your original question, Chris, they are bringing with them all kinds of stuff. They bring money, literally carrying cash on their persons. They send money. There are monthly lineups at the banks for people sending money all from all over the world, particularly the United States. It's one of the primary sources of income right now in Cuba. And they are making relations much more open between the two places so that there is now in Florida, it's a minority voice in terms of power, but I think it's fair to say not a minority voice in terms of actual numbers, calling for diplomatic conversations, calling for change through exposure and pressure and talk, rather than the kind of dump them all and start all over again change that has been the real motto of the most deeply held of the anti-Cuban community.
So what has been the result of this loosening of sanctions on private enterprise, private land ownership? How robust has that effort been, and what sort of changes has it created in Cuba?
Well, I think it's fair to say right now that it is erratic and that people are very uncertain about how things will proceed with it. Let me explain, first of all, what they did technically, which is about a little over a year ago now, the government, by official decree, after a series of long round-the-country conversations, allowed a little over 180 new categories of what in Spanish is called cuenta propismo, which literally means the keeping of one's own accounts. And what this means is small businesses that it was now, after this decree, legal to commence. Now, you have to understand that Cubans are very entrepreneurial by long tradition, and many of these businesses had been conducted illegally. But if the government found out that you were doing it, they could shut you down because these were supposed to be things done under the context of the government, by the people and for the people at government wage. Nonetheless, lots of Cubans would go out and do this on the side. Now, after this decree, you could legitimately go out and, for example, sell sandwiches on your front porch, sell DVDs. So selling is one of the main self-enterprise activities that you will see now on a daily basis underway in Cuba, but there are many more, certain kinds of plumbing, certain home repairs, roof repairs, things like that, that, again, used not to be legal for you to do for your own private benefit. These are taxed, and, of course, Cubans unaccustomed to the concept of taxes because everything was supposedly done by the government and paid for by the government grumble a lot about their taxes. And there are a lot of areas that, at least at the point that I was there, and I think to this day, are still not permitted for cuenta propismo. For example, you cannot legally be a lawyer working for your own account. Lawyers are paid by the government. You can't be an engineer working on your own account because the government's rationale is our educational system is still free, and it is, in fact, free. And so we've put all these public resources into paying you. It's not right that you then go and take all the public resources that we put into your education and use that training for your own private benefit. That's not fair. So that's why you can't do it. That's why doctors are not allowed to practice on their own account either. So what you see now, the fascinating part about all of this is that at the same time that the government on paper is encouraging individual enterprise, and the vocabulary is very freighted in Spanish right now, it is not encouraging individual accumulation of profit. Individual wealth is still considered inappropriate and contrary to the revolutionary spirit. All this is said publicly at the same time that everybody understands that one of the byproducts of the revolution has been creating a class of politically keyed-in people who live in, by Cuban standards, relative wealth, make lots of money on the side, running little businesses that are not quite legitimate, but they have revolutionary credentials, and so it's kind of okay for them to do it. This is the cause of tremendous resentment within Cuba. People who followed the Soviet Union and the breakup of the Soviet Union will recognize many of these themes. It's, you know, it's Orwellian. All of us are equal, but some of us are more equal than others. And Cubans are very, as I think I mentioned before, there are many, many fascinating things about Cuba, about being in Cuba right now. But one of them is that it is, I've traveled a lot in Latin America, and Cuba is an extraordinarily educated place. It is a place where people who would be very poor and very poorly educated in most Latin American countries have quite high levels of education right now. So the nature of the argument is very robust in Cuba, with people having all kinds of vigorous views on this. And how they will, one of the things that I was thinking about when I was there is that they are trying to encourage individual enterprise at the same time that they're actively trying to discourage any kind of a Cuban Sam Walton fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion that you go into business with an idea in the back of your head that this little storefront business is going to turn someday into an enormous company with thousands and thousands of employees and you living in a big mansion is not okay mm-hmm. in the Cuba of 2012. They view that as the problem with capitalism, one of the many, and not where they want to end up. And I've talked to lots of people in Cuba who are very critical of what's going on now, very eager to see change happen, very interested in life in the United States, and at the same time, very distressed about aspects of United States life which are accurate, which are not propaganda, that we really do have people here who make tens of thousands of times more than other people, that healthcare really is something we expect people to pay for, that we don't guarantee a university education to everyone at public cost. They think... Most Cubans I talk to really think that's not right. That's not how a society ought to operate, at the same time that they're highly critical of the inefficiency and self-contradictory nature of Cuban society.
It does seem, and you've mentioned it a couple of times, and for me to get my head around this is almost impossible. Throughout most of Latin America, and in fact most of the developing world, the difference between the wealthy and the poor is very often education. Like if you could get everybody a good education, there would be no poverty. And in Cuba, The opposite is true. And you write about the case of an ER physician who his official salary is like $32 a month. And so he works in the ER, and then he drives a cab to make real money to support his family.
This is so fascinating, Chris, and let me see if I can explain this just in words quickly in a way that will make sense to people. And I want to stress that if this sounds confusing and headache-inducing to you, it's because it is. The fastest way to start a really affectionate, long, complicated conversation in Cuba is to turn to somebody and say, I don't understand the economy. Mm-hmm. And the Cuban you're talking to will burst out laughing and say, ay, chica, nobody understands the economy. Of course you don't understand our economy. And then you'll really get rolling, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let me see if I can put it this way. During the time when Cuba's economy was really being held up by the Soviet Union, the 1970s and the 1980s, it was a time people will describe of relative satisfaction in Cuba because the main thing Cuba was producing at that point, with the Soviet Union to hold it up, was educated people. It had a populace that from the countryside, from all over, was being invited, encouraged to get a university education and often a postgraduate university education. Cuba's medical system was justifiably famous during that period. They were, in fact, it's not propaganda, they were exporting physicians all over the world. They had better, they do now, well, they did at least a decade ago, they had better health indicators in many ways than the U.S. does in terms of infant mortality and so on and widespread medical care. So their main export became people with great educations. The problem is they weren't making anything besides educated Cubans. And Cubans all over the place will tell you this. This is not sort of one side view of Cuba. That was the main thing they were producing was educated Cubans. The Soviet Union falls apart. The primary source of money, which is coming in from the Soviet Union by means of all kinds of jerry-rigged sugar deals, where the Soviets are paying far more for the Cuban sugar than it's worth, falls apart. Cuba plunges into a tremendous depression, much more severe in many ways than the U.S. depression of the 1930s. People are genuinely starving, and you hear stories about people during that period eating grapefruit rind for dinner and things like that.
Mm.
As they try to get out of their depression, the only thing they can think to do, because they're not now producing anything, their sugar's fallen apart, their oil is lousy and can't be used, they don't make anything. What do they make? They make Cubans, they make educated Cubans, and they make lovely settings for tourists to come in. So they start throwing open a very, very dramatically a tourist industry that relies on people. If they can sneak in from the U.S., great. They come in from Mexico. Lots come in from Europe and from Canada. And those people bring with them hard currency, U.S. dollars. So the situation they're in right now, because they still haven't figured out how to make anything, they're exploring for oil, but there are all kinds of problems. They don't have a robust oil industry. The sugar industry is still lousy. So the main thing they still make is an attractive, revolutionary, beautiful beaches Cuba that tourists genuinely enjoy. It's a wonderful place to go in many ways if you're a tourist. And that means that the only way for people to reliably earn hard currency in Cuba, meaning the money that comes in, most of it is U.S. dollars or as euros, is by working in the tourist industry. So most of the people who work in the tourist industry are extremely well educated, even to the point of being, for example, physicians and engineers and so on. This is one of the things that's the most bewildering for people when they arrive. The odds are in Cuba that your cab driver is an engineer or a doctor. The guy serving you a drink in the bar probably has an advanced degree in psychology or geology. And the reason he's working in the bar is that he will make the equivalent of 10 or 12 or 15 times more collecting your tips in the money that's in one of the Cuban currencies that's been converted from your U.S. dollars than he will working in his government job where he serves the people and he's paid in Cuban money and he gets lots of things free, but he can't buy the things that he actually wants.
Hmm.
So that's the other thing about Cuba that's so perplexing for an outsider to understand. that physician who appears in my article, who, as you mentioned, works in an emergency room part-time where he makes $32 a month, and he makes much more than that on his other days of driving his dad's old beater around as a taxi, it is true, he only makes $32 a month as a physician, but remember that he can also, he's gotten his whole education free, his kids' education is going to be free, all of their health care is free, and there are a whole host of sort of low-end things that he can buy at very reduced rates, certain kinds of subsidized food, the terrible newspapers, books, fiction, things like that, movies he can go to really cheap. What he can't get, and he needs the foreign money to get, is an enormous array of things that we in the U.S. and in most of the outside Cuba world regard as kind of borderline discretionary but necessary. One of the things I heard referred to most often in Cuba was deodorant, perfume. Cubans like to make themselves attractive, like most people. And I would hear women in particular say over and over, this is a tropical country. We smell bad if we don't use deodorant and perfume. We can't buy it with what we make in our government money. This is why we're out earning tourist dollars, driving taxis, working as maids, running little hotels for the tourists. So that's one of the only reliable places right now to get the money with which you can buy the things you actually want is working in the tourist trade or having a relative bring in stuff for you that comes in from the outside that you can then sell.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Kurt on the line in Dallas. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, I just wanted to touch base on one comment, actually a little blurb in the magazine. It basically said that the government pretends to pay the people and the people pretend to like their jobs, something to that effect. And, you know, in talking about the doctor with his degree, how qualified would he be as far as if he moved to the United States as a doctor? How good is the education in comparison to what we would view as a stellar education in the United States?
That's a really interesting question. I don't have a lot of real authority to answer it, Kurt, but it's interesting. The short answer is most Cuban doctors are regarded as quite well-trained or have been until recently. There's been so much infrastructure deterioration in the hospitals now that a lot of Cubans will tell you that the famous health system is awful in many, many respects. You can still, it's great in the sense that a poor child can get a heart transplant without having to go through insurance nightmares. It's terrible in the sense that there's been so little investment in the hospital and the health structures that I heard this repeatedly from people, from Cubans. If you have a relative who goes in the hospital, you got to bring your own bed sheets in. You better bring that relative food. You better have somebody in the room to make sure that the room is clean because no one will clean it. So the training is good except for the infrastructure problem. And the line that you referred to, which I heard over and over again, as a reference to the problem with the government is they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work.
Journalist Cynthia Gorney is my guest. Her story, Cuba's New Now, appears in the November issue of National Geographic magazine. We'll come back to our talk in a few minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Cynthia Gorney. Her story, Cuba's New Now, appears in the November issue of National Geographic magazine. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Cynthia, when you talk about hospital infrastructure being allowed to sort of go to pot, and in the story you have accounts of buildings crumbling because they have not been kept up, I'm wondering why all the money, all the revenue from opening up tourism hasn't provided enough for government to pay for those things?
I don't have a good answer for that question, Chris, except to tell you that the needs are so great and the tourism money is just not enough. They have very ambitious plans for quintupling their tourist facilities that are on the books right now, but it's a very complicated enterprise. International conglomerates that come in, and there are many such in Cuba, that want to do business with the Cubans have to share their revenues, I believe it's 51%, with the Cubans. That has not gone over very well for some chains. And I heard stories, there are Spanish chains, for example, that have very well-regarded hotels in Cuba that seem to run with some success. But one of the Cuban traditions that lingers from particularly the Depression years is one in which Cubans regard any workplace as perfectly fair territory from which you steal anything that you can so that you can go and resell it on the black market or use it in your home. And there's no moral, there's nothing moral attached to this, because if you're trying to raise your family with the government equivalent of $32 a month for your salary, even if the health care is free, you just don't have enough to feed your family, and you certainly don't have enough to buy your kid a nice pair of shoes or a toy now and then.
So you do what you got to do.
There's a verb I write about in the piece. In Spanish, the verb luchar literally means to fight, mm-hmm. but in Cuba it has a whole special meaning. And the way I defined it in the piece is it means I'm bringing that thing home from my workplace because the government doesn't pay me enough to buy myself a lousy bottle of beer. So I deserve this. That's what luchar means. And there's a whole bunch of other verbs. The word for invent in English, you know, inventar, mm-hmm. Means I sort of put it together in some way. I improvised my way into getting my washing machine to work or getting my kid to have a bicycle that actually works so that my kid can go back and forth to school. What happens with this tradition is everybody understands that any workplace is going to have an enormously high pilferage rate. And I heard accounts of European corporations that are accustomed to a much more streamlined and open, if you will, form of business being astonished when they come in and they pay their bartenders what they think is a really good wage, and they still find that two-thirds of the good liquor is disappearing out the back, or the flour that's supposed to be used for the bread is disappearing out the back, or the fish, I mean, you name it. And so this also has made the building of these facilities more problematic. In addition to complicate problems, they have a very poor infrastructure in the country for traveling place to place. It's not that big an island, but it's a pretty hefty journey to get from Havana, say, to the historical sites of the east or southern parts of the island. And your options right now are going in a bus for many hours, or getting on a plane. There are airports, and they're interior airports, and delays of 7, 8, 9 hours for your plane are really common. I had 2 or 3 of those while I was there, and the Cubans just looked at me like, hello, welcome to our lives.
What's your problem, lady?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jerry on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, good day. Yes, I had a question. Please elaborate on this. As I understand it, there's no natural resources, very little, and there's no industrial base. And then, of course, you don't allow outside industries in. Where's Cuba standing with the World Bank?
That's a very good question, Jerry. Part of the problem has been that if you have any familiarity with the way the World Bank tends to operate, it typically demands a pretty severe restructuring of the way that governments do their resource allocation. When the World Bank will come in and offer to do a big project, it will say, for example, no, you can't offer free education to everybody. You can't go on subsidizing food like this. You can't insist that everybody's health care be free. You got to make these changes so that your system works more in what we regard as an efficient way, business-like, and the Cubans just won't do that. They have dug in their heels. They really do. On some philosophical level, Cuba is still run by people who genuinely regard the place as one of the last, maybe the last, working socialist enterprise in the U.S. Now, that will occasion lots of cynical laughter from Cubans who say, we're not socialist, I don't know what socialist means anymore, and the place doesn't work. But nonetheless, they're not willing to make the kinds of changes that the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank typically requires in order to take that money. And your question really goes to the heart, which is what's really troubling to a lot of Cubans, of what are we going to make if we're going to climb our way out of this thing? Are we going to ramp our sugar production back up? That's one possibility. If we do that, are we going to produce sugar to feed the fuel needs that have created complicated sugar industries in other countries? They've put a lot of hope into oil production. Everybody understands that there is a lot of oil in the fields outside Cuba. But so far, a lot of their hopes have really been disappointed over this last year. They've had a whole series of foreign consortiums coming in and doing deep water drilling. And I'm certainly no oil expert. I'm sure there are many, many more of you in the Texas listening audience who are. But my understanding of the oil problem is that the crude down there is very, very heavy. It's dirty crude. And what they're looking for is crude that is actually usable and can be pumped properly. And so far, they have not had success at finding that. So they're sort of screwed as far as all that goes right now.
I'll tell you what astonished me in this article was your account of a young man who had made his way to Florida for several years from Cuba and then went back. First of all, I did not imagine such a thing was possible and that someone like that would be welcome back.
Well, there is a gathering movement. Movement is too strong a word. There is some gathering practice of that right now. And what Josue is the name of the guy that you're referring to, a young man in his early 30s, who was really disenchanted by what he encountered among Cubans in Miami. And I've heard this a lot. I've heard him from Cubans in Miami as well as from Cuba, that what happens is the ones who actually hit Florida get so intoxicated with American materialistic values that they go sort of nuts. And I heard a very funny account, for example, from a Cuban physician who has been able to go and visit relatives and come back, of how crazy she thinks life in the U.S. is. She'd talk about these people jumping on their horses. She was using cowboy metaphors and go out and ride the freeways all day long, and they work 14 hours a day. They never see their families. All they care about is who has a bigger car and who has a three-car garage. This is not a life that people should be living, she says, from her Cuban perspective. So Josue was distressed by this, among other things. He ran into a health complication. He had classic U.S. Health hang-ups with that. He had stopped working for the place he was working for. He didn't have insurance. And he was also he had relatives that he wanted to help take care of. He has an elderly grandma that he feels an obligation to. And he sees the new encouragement of entrepreneurship in Cuba as very promising. He didn't want to get rich. He wants to open with his wife, who happens to be a Russian national, which gives her a very interesting perspective on changes out of socialism. He wants to open a bed and breakfast. And are we there?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm glad we're here.
Yeah. And his notion of a good, independent entrepreneur life is not to be Sam Walton. It's to run a nice place where people can enjoy Cuban values, good Cuban food, maybe drink fresh goat milk from the goats there, and he and his wife get to live as they wish to live. He didn't see America as a particularly great place to do this, and he's hoping that the new Cuba will be.
What does it take for Cubans to fill their bellies? I have to tell you, another thing that took me by surprise was learning that the markets don't have fish in a place like Cuba. It reminded me of the accounts years ago of Argentina rationing beef.
It's really interesting. One of the first lines you'll hear before you start getting deeper into the layers of Cuban conversation is nobody goes hungry in Cuba. Nobody dies of hunger. That's the first thing people will say as they're defending the Cuban Revolution. And it's true. Nobody dies of hunger in Cuba. It's also true as you walk around Cuba that the visible signs of hunger and malnutrition are not present the way you see them in many, many other Latin American countries, almost everyone that I've traveled and worked in. What happens is two things. Number one, the fact that there is government subsidy for certain basic foods, although it's definitely not enough to keep anybody alive, surely helps. Number two, as I mentioned before in other contexts, Cubans are incredibly entrepreneurial. And a Cuban family will do anything it takes to put a good meal on the table. So when they complain of food shortages, they're not complaining, I don't have enough to keep my kid healthy during the day. Their complaint is, this isn't fair. I go to the hotel buffets, or my cousin sneaks in there because he's one of the waiter, and the tables are just overloaded with 15 kinds of seafood and 5 kinds of breads and multiple salads and beautiful island foods, and I can't get any of those unless I have access to foreign currency and unless I know the guy on the street corner whose house is the third one from the left, who if I knock in a certain way will sell me the fish out the back, because I can't get the fish in the market because there isn't any shortage in the because there isn't enough in the market.
So they're getting beans and rice and oil and very absolute basic foods,
well,
sugar.
That's not quite fair. The Cuban diet is actually good and varied. It's simple, but it's good and varied.
Mm-hmm.
Chicken, beans, rice at every meal, fruits, vegetables. What the Cubans will complain about is that the system is so erratic that they'll have to go. A Cuban housewife will tell you, I have to go to 7 different stores to get what I need, to get my coffee, to get my milk, to get my basics. And so what they'll complain about is the difficulty of trying to obtain the stuff, the fact that you got to go into the black market or por la izquierda, as they say, on the left, mm-hmm. To be able to get the basic stuff you need, and that it's just not fair because so many of these foods are available to the tourists and to the relative wealthy in Cuba, but not to the people who are the Cubans who are supposed to be the revolutionaries. So it's a disparity that frustrates people, but at the same time, they take great pride in the fact that, as they say, nobody dies of hunger in Cuba, and there is a much more basic, healthy standard of living in the island than in many other countries where the income disparity is very, very much greater.
So how old is Raul Castro now? Like late 70s?
86.
86. Oh,
mm-hmm.
Excuse me, late 80s. Clearly, people must be thinking of what the country will look like after his death.
Yeah, and one of the other things, one byproduct of the press, the regular straight press is being so bad, and the Cuban culture of one-party closedness, is that if you're outside those circles, even among journalists, it's very unclear what will happen. There are a few people who are sort of pointed to as potential next-level folk, but there is the Cubans will adamantly defend their one-party system as saying this is our way of being democratic. And when you look at places that have gone to multi-party systems, what do you get when you look around us? You get Haiti. Do we want that? Mm. Thank you very much. We do not. We would rather have the kind of stability in government that we have now and sacrifice some of what you guys might call political freedoms. But there is no clear heir apparent. And I think what happens, Raul seems to be in good health, although Fidel obviously is not. They're keeping rumors that he's actually in a coma. But he cannot last in office, certainly another decade, probably another half decade. And there is no clear path for what happens when he's gone, although I'm sure that people, as we speak, are desperately trying to work that out.
So in the very beginning, you open the story with a young man named Eduardo who tells you of his plan to leave the country. And I won't ask you to tell his entire story, but talk about the fact that people who don't want to leave still get it, still understand why their neighbors do.
This is one of the things I found most surprising of many, many surprising things. When I went to, I keep thinking of one of the people I went to who is most well-known in Cuba as a very articulate, eloquent, educated, courtly guy. He's the editor of a big socialist magazine that has an international readership audience. And he's kind of one of the go-to people for Western journalists who want to understand the line because other people are very reluctant to talk to us. And one of the first things I said, here's this guy I know, and he's right now, he and his buddies are building a boat to get out because he's so frustrated, and he has this litany of complaints, which I've heard all over the island. What would you say to him? And this guy said, I get it. He needs to go figure it out. I get it. He said, my own daughter, she's very loyal, he said, my own daughter has many friends who've gone. My own daughter has thought about going. It's not easy here, but, he went on to say, I really believe that the new generation is going to come of age and figure out how to keep the values that make Cuba what it is without turning it into some kind of a temple of capitalism, without letting it be destroyed. And those are the people that we're really counting on. The ones who leave are not going to be here to sort of see what happens, but at the same time, I understand why they need to go.
Journalist Cynthia Gorney is a contributor to National Geographic magazine. Her story, Cuba's New Now, appears in the November issue. Cynthia, always such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It was nice to be with you.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Bye.